Blog Talk Radio.
I've tried a thousand times to break down my door, and I've lied a thousand lies to try to get beyond these walls and chains that bind and hold me to the ground. I've cried a thousand cries, but no one hears a sound. I'm so tired of my life.
Good evening, and welcome to Spotlight for Justice, a podcast by the National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation. I'm your host, Michelle Bart, and in a few minutes, I will bring on my co-host, Dr. Kathy Mathis, and our guests this evening, Paul and Julia Nichols. Tuesday, October 9th, 2012, a teenage girl from Colorado Springs went missing. In June of 2012, NW Cave and our Missing Children's Division had just received our tax exemption. One of our friends at the Orlando Sentinel asked if we would take on a new case. Being a new agency, he wasn't sure. Bruce, who has since passed in the last 11 years, contacted Marjorie Nichols, Cara's aunt, and on November 1st, 2012, after almost 30 days that this teenage girl, beautiful, beautiful girl, Cara Nichols, was missing, nothing had been done in the spotlight to shed a light that one of Colorado Springs' own children had been missing. So we were retained by Paul and Julia Nichols, and we began what, as of today, has been 11 years and our longest case for our Missing Children's Division. The case took a detour in February of 2022 when Cara's remains were found. Cara's remains were found, as you will hear tonight, on a property that wasn't a surprise to many of us that have been on this case all these years. We're going to talk to Paul and Julia Nichols and possibly some of her friends that will call in tonight. They made an arrest. The individual was prosecuted, and I say this very lightly, to the fullest extent of the pathetic laws in Colorado Springs, to 24 years with time served. And we're going to dissect that as well, because those laws, he is only serving 24 years, not because of the murder to Cara, but because he was a habitual criminal. So with that, I'd like to bring on Dr. Mathis. Kathy, are you with us?
I am. Thank you for introducing me, and hello to you and everybody listening today.
Thanks for being with us. And for anyone listening this evening, if you'd like to call in and ask any questions of Cara's parents, myself, or Dr. Mathis, the call-in number is 515-602-9601. Without further ado, I'd like to bring on Julia Nichols. Julia, are you with us?
Can you hear me?
Oh, I can. Can you hear us?
Yes. Yes, I'm here. Paul does not feel well tonight, so he will not be with us. But
okay. Extend our well wishes to him. Welcome to Spotlight for Justice again, Julia. As I was mentioning to Kathy before we went to air, it's mind-boggling. We've been doing this for many, many years with families, and it's sad. And the reality is, as a parent, you're supposed to report your child missing. Then when you do, she's a teenager, so it's not priority. Then as a parent, you're supposed to look for your missing child because that's really the thing to do. But of course, you would think you would have a whole slew of help from those that are supposed to be looking for the missing, which we know that wasn't the case over the years. Ultimately throughout the years, we have to be careful with what we say because we don't know who the perpetrator is that has your daughter. So if there's trafficking involved, et cetera, we don't want to make it even a worse situation for our parents. So then we're kind of quieted then. And then as we move on and remains are found, then we have to be quiet because now we can't defame the defendant because he hasn't been prosecuted yet. So then the family members, like you've been faced with for 11 years, had to be muzzled again. And then he's finally arrested and he's now in court. Now we got to be careful because we can't taint the jury pool. So we were originally scheduled for this show a couple months back and we had to wait because you couldn't speak out in case it would taint the jury pool because maybe somebody in Colorado Springs listens to Spotlight for Justice. And then he's prosecuted. And we still have to be careful because now we have to wait another month for sentencing and we don't want to upset the judge who's going to do the sentencing. And then at the end of the day, he gets sentenced, and now you can speak. And so Kathy and I are here to ask a couple questions, but I want this to be your show.
Well, it really was, from start to finish, just an appalling situation. Totally outrageous, and it leaves my whole family feeling very violated. There are very few rights of the victims and victims' families, and all the rights go to treating a despicable human being with kid gloves. And furthermore, his defense team gets to use any kind of devious tactics that they so desire, while the prosecution, with justice on their side, has to, again, tiptoe around and obfuscate the truth, which, in my opinion, is the definition of heinousness.
Definitely. And you're speaking about the trial, where we all sat through the trial for 2 weeks and watched how, In order to defend the defendant, we could not say that he was an habitual criminal. He was not an abusive husband. They brought out his wife as a witness, and the ex-wife and the FBI agent were muzzled, were not able to say that there was any violence in his history, and that's why she had a lifetime restraining order, and that's why she's in witness protection, and that's why she lives across the country with her kids, because of how dangerous this man was during their marriage. Furthermore, she was the one that when they came knocking, she fessed up where Cara's remains were. And then ultimately, the prosecutors could not defend Cara, as the defense re-victimized a poor teenage girl and threw her through the ringer.
They could they could say whatever they wanted, any version of lies that they wanted to say. They basically had the case done for them. They didn't have to put forth any effort because of all the legalities and rulings of the judge as to what evidence could be brought forth, what witnesses could say, who could be a witness. It basically was a slam dunk for his lazy defense team, who came very unprepared and very unprofessional and just could sit there and smirk and laugh. They had total control, and it was truly a disgusting kangaroo court. I will never get over this, the process that we were put through and the victimization and the goings on of that so-called trial.
And
one of the things that you're finding out, one of the things that we are finding out, Julia, in this case, as well as many other people have found out, is that when you get into court, you don't go into court and receive justice. We go into court, we hope we get justice. But what we find out once we're in there, that justice is not what the court is about. First of all, it's about protecting criminals and trying to destroy a victim or a survivor or both. It's also about not having justice served, because you can't tell the truth about a person's past criminal behavior, and which I find so disgusting, because if you want to know who somebody is, you look at their criminal behavior and that tells you who they are, yet you're silenced and told, well, that has nothing to do with this case, in which I so wholeheartedly disagree. Because a criminal is a criminal, and they don't do just one act. They do many acts, and all of that should be taken into account in a criminal case. And then the third thing is, and this was something I was sharing with Michelle, that I had heard an attorney say, and that was, when you go into court, the truth becomes lies, and the lies become truth. I was dumbfounded when I heard an attorney say that. And that's what you have found out in this case, that, you know, the court is not what people have been taught it is. It is not where you go in and they protect the truth and the truth will set you free, so to speak, because they don't allow the truth to be spoken. So my heart goes out. Go ahead.
The outrageous thing in our situation was, they could say anything they wanted to about our daughter out of context, and that was fair game. Her past was fair game. Her difficulties in life were brought forth out of context and not truthfully, but anything in order to put her in a terrible light. In effect, it was really as though she were on trial. And that came across loud and clear to the members of the jury, who, I don't want to say anything that I shouldn't say, but it seemed to me that they were not very capable of understanding nuance or even understanding with any common sense what was going on. So as for Michelle's earlier point about us being muzzled so as to not taint the jury pool, I hardly think that would have mattered one iota. But
with the jury, though, in this particular case, the news KRDO received an email from one of the jurors during after the trial and before sentencing, and so with that letter, and then obviously now hearing the family and everyone speaking out against what transpired in court, even jurors actually were like, if we had known that, that would have made a big difference. Yeah, I would think it would make a big difference that the ex-wife that led us to Cara's remains, because she knew what happened, because she had to run from her husband and get into protection from him, that would play a factor that if you say anything, that will happen to you again, and that would happen to you too. You know, that those are threats. And as Kathy says, when someone shows you who they are, believe them. When you have a track record and a huge rap sheet, especially of violence against especially women, you would think that they would want that to come in. But
right.
Criminals across this country, anything against them that could show their mentality of why they did what they did. Like, he was going through a messy divorce right around that same time. I truly believe he strangled Cara thinking it was his wife. I've taken Kathy's classes, Understanding the Mind of a Predator. The man was going through a very dirty divorce. She was going to take him for what he had, which was not much of anything, but she was going to try. And they were going through a messy thing that was proven on his posts on Facebook. So, and his mother's for that matter. And so it was just, you know, none of that could play a factor in the testimony. But like to Julia's point, Dr. Mathis, everything on Cara, she was only 19 years old, 19. Not only did the defense make her look like the criminal, but during the entire search efforts of almost 10 years, the re-victimization, the exploitation of even law enforcement when they were advertising she was missing was a disgrace to this poor child and this family.
Right. And we suspect that Cara was trafficked. We know that she did not have a credit card, and the detectives told us at one point during the investigation that she did not place this so-called ad. So, in other words, an unknown trafficker must have done so, and yet they made it seem like she was a seasoned madam in a, you know, from the, you know, old-time Western, I don't know, old movies or something. It was absurd. And I just can't get over the travesty that occurred. We know also the judge made choices. He in an earlier hearing in the month of May ruled that some of his priors could not be, counted, and anything that had to do with domestic violence. And that was a choice. That he did not have to rule in such a way. I believe it was a very misogynistic, paternalistic kind of choice, and I think that it hamstrung the prosecutors. I think a lot of their case fell apart even before they started.
I would agree with you on that. The judge did not have to withhold and say that couldn't be brought in, because as we know, this guy has had numerous violations of protection orders that he violated over the years. We also know he had harassment charges against him as well. And then I'm going to go back to what Michelle said when he strangled Kara. You have a person who, first of all, has entitlement, who is misogynistic, who believes that they can do whatever they want to and do whatever they want to. And they have a past history of, you know, crimes against women, et cetera. So in his, whether he was angry, whether he was not angry, that's neither here nor there. The fact was he made a choice. And this is what everybody needs to understand with these criminals. They make a choice. And it doesn't matter what profession their victim has. It doesn't matter what age that victim is. It is all on the predator to understand that that criminal makes a choice to do what they did. So knowing that that's the mindset and where they go with this, then if they are making a choice to hurt and harm and have a past history of doing that, why on earth would a judge, unless he also or she also is a misogynistic or sexist abuser themselves, withhold pertinent information that would say this person has a pattern of not liking women? It
yes,
makes no
as
sense.
As a matter of fact, to your point, we were, of course, listening into every single hearing over the past year and a half. And at the hearing where the judge made that ruling, the judge believed that he was not violent to his ex-wife, even though the police report said that he pushed her and knocked her down the stairs. But apparently this judge doesn't believe that that is an act of violence. So he said, well, those behaviors don't qualify as violent, so I'm not going to allow them. We
so
were
what
dumb
do about. They qualify as?
Then? I don't know. According to this judge, I guess that's the way men should treat women.
Well, see, that's my point, and thank you for, you know, bringing it to that, is because, first of all, a judge should never be able to make that decision. They weren't there. They do not know what happened. Second of all, anybody that uses power and control against somebody, whether it's a shove, a push, you know, whatever it is, that is an act that is abusive, and it is against the law to put your hands on somebody else and move them in any direction, you know, in a certain way where they can lose their balance and get hurt and harmed. So the judge, first of all, doesn't even follow the law. Second of all, the judge is undertrained, apparently, in understanding what abuse and violence is, because to them, maybe pulling out a gun and shooting somebody is violent. Strangling somebody is violent. But a person, again, and I'm going to go back to the criminal. A criminal doesn't choose to strangle somebody if they have not worked their way up to the point of strangling somebody by doing prior violent acts.
Right, right. But apparently the jury and the people of Colorado Springs believe it's possible to accidentally strangle someone. That's a thing out in Colorado Springs, I guess. It defies logic and common sense. Anyone we've spoken to doesn't live in that area of the country has been aghast at this whole process.
Yeah, because to accidentally strangle somebody is not really based in reality, because when you put your hands on somebody else's neck and you squeeze to the point of them losing the ability to breathe, there are some signs that show you that you're doing that. So, you know, it wasn't like it was, you know, one thing and it was over with in a second. To strangle somebody, you know, you have to put your hands or something around their neck, and you have to purposely put enough pressure on it so that within 3 minutes, that person is going to what? Be gagging, spitting, slobbering, gasping for air, turning blue, etc. And that gives you time to stop. But, oh, no, it was an accident. I went longer than that.
Right. And of course, we were treated to the delightful testimony at the trial of how experienced this person was in his perverse games, as they put it, so that he would have known, according to the testimony we had to listen to. It was just
And let's just get to the game. The game was, you know, that they're talking about is strangulation sex. Let's just put it out there. Strangulation sex, unless you're doing strangulation sex on yourself and nobody else is involved, you might not be able to keep yourself alive. But when you're doing
and the
it
two
to
of them had,
well,
and the two of them had a thing where the wife would tap on his hand to say enough. And
right. There's usually a code word.
Somebody else wouldn't have known that.
Yeah, yeah. But that's what I'm
saying.
I think
we have a caller. So hold that thought, Dr. Mathis. Caller, do you have a question from the 719 area code?
Is that me?
Yes.
Hi. My name's Erin, and I was a friend of Cara's.
Hi, Erin.
Wanted to also say I called in as soon as I heard everyone talking about the judge. I had posted on Facebook about what the judge did on court. And I had multiple women message me saying that that same judge had ruled in their abuser's favor in one way or another.
Oh, my God.
It just makes this even more just absolutely disgusting.
You would think there'd be an investigation into that.
I truly hope there is, because
I would love to find out a way that we could get the ball rolling on that. That is truly appalling, Erin. Thank you for telling us that.
Yeah, I needed to say something as soon as we were talking about that judge. I just thought of that, and it was not okay. And for Julia, my heart's just with you so much all the time, and we all miss Cara so much. She was really involved in the community, and she was friends with so many people. And the way they painted her out to be was just so far from the truth of who she actually was.
And thank you for letting us know about the judge as well, because what people need to understand is there is no repercussion to a judge unless everybody writes into the Judicial Council to the state of Colorado and make a complaint. So all of these people that were saying this particular judge showed, you know, misogynistic siding with and colluding with perpetrators, that needs to be reported so that the Judicial Council has a record of it. Second of all, everybody, when there's a judge like this that's out there that obviously has no clue about how to protect a victim because they themselves are either undertrained or abusers themselves, you don't vote for them the next time around, because outside of those two things, there's not a whole lot anybody can do against a judge.
I don't think they have judicial voting. I think somebody told me the rule in Colorado is that
Driver.
Yeah, what was it? It was you write in or you...
It's not like... They're not elected.
Here we get to actually... They're on the ballot and we write yes or no for judicial retention, I think. I'm not sure what...
Yeah. You can vote them out. You can't vote them in. Something like that.
Yeah.
And there is a way to file a report as well. I'm just not completely sure what that is.
Well, in most of the states, there's always what's called the Judicial Council, which is the presiding body over all of the judges for that state. And they have on their website a section where you can make a complaint against a judge. And then if there's several people that make a complaint against the judge, they review each one and decide whether to sanction the judge, take the judge off of the bench, you know, whatever it is. And so Colorado may not have the ability to vote a judge in, but you certainly have the ability in Colorado to take a judge off the bench.
Well, to Aaron's point, and also Julia's point, the two-week trial had so many things that were just injustices every which way you looked at it. And one was like Judge Bain, which is his name, he was so gentle with the witness, which was the defendant's mother. And when she got off the stand, she goes, Judge, can I go over and give my son a hug? And he goes, no, ma'am, I'm sorry, but you can throw him a kiss right then and there. Yeah. That was so, like Julia and Paul were saying on our side, they were like, I can't throw my daughter a kiss, you know, so it was just every little bit like that. And the fact, because of the way he held back, not allowing evidence into play about this man's habitual criminal history at the time of trial, he was acquitted on charges of first and second degree murder. He only got a mandatory sentence of manslaughter, which was a maximum of like 6 years. The only reason he's behind bars for 24, with time served no less, so about 22, maybe 23 years, is because then they had to do a month and a half later another trial on his habitual criminal history. So not only did you waste taxpayers' dollars by having two different things, if you brought that in at the time of this, that jury would have probably got him on first or second degree, and it would have saved taxpayers in Colorado Springs thousands of dollars for another trial. But then he was given all that extra time.
Well, and speaking of other evidence as well that wasn't said in front of the jury, I went to all of the court hearings coming up to the trial, and I heard about evidence that there was blood found in the trunk of his car that didn't match Kara's DNA or his DNA. So this guy could have hurt so many people, and no evidence regarding that was allowed to be said in front of the jury.
And to segue into that, because you've brought it up, Aaron, the fact is we provided numerous tips that came to us in 2013, 2014 to the Sheriff's Department and said, we have reason to believe where Kara's phone pinged, there may be as many as 10 women, escorts, that's what the tipster called them, escorts on a ranch property. Fast forward to 2022, Kara's body is found on a ranch. And so I truly believe, and I've told the DA's office this, I've told the media this, and I put it in my a victim impact statement, which I was impressed that we were allowed to make. I've told everybody that property needs to be dug up. And still, I guarantee you it hasn't been touched.
And I don't know how, because in the initial search in 2014, there were over 10 ground disturbances sensed with the radar that they used in 2014. And no digging.
Yeah, they claim that that's because this family liked to bury animals all over the place. But to me, the whole thing from start to finish was sloppy and derelict in terms of its investigation and the resources that they chose not to allocate to this. Even in so far as other people coming forward after the news broke in February of 2022, and those people not being listened to or added to the investigation in terms of other abused women coming forward with information.
And other missing women.
Yeah, everything about this entire scenario just smacks of injustice after injustice after injustice. And even I do know about that car trunk. We did ask about that. Apparently, they couldn't or wouldn't track down the owner of the car that was sold and resold. They had originally testimony about that and evidence, but since they couldn't track down the owner, the provenance of the car, it was not to be admitted at trial. There was some complication. I think they just didn't want to devote the resources to tracking that person down. Personally,
right.
I agree. I think
and that's
that,
something different than I heard when I was going to the earlier hearings before trial. I had heard that they did find the car that he had when Cara went missing, and the trunk had been refurbished, but they ran forensics on it. That's what I remember from the earlier court hearings. And by the way, his father owned kind of like a you pull and pay car junkyard, and so it makes sense that the trunk was refurbished.
Right.
I believe that the entire family was involved in this.
I agree.
Right.
So I have a question because I wasn't there. So it sounds to me like you had a judge, obviously, that failed. You also had, detectives that failed?
Over and over again. Call me a conspiracy theorist, but the initial detective or sheriff that was first involved in Cara's case, who had told her own father to stop calling in about her, he's involved in some
He was indicted.
I don't know what I'm allowed to say, but
he was indicted
locally,
on his own issues.
Well,
my mom
knows him from being in the community for so long, and it's been known that he's involved in, like, certain clubs.
So he's corrupt.
Oh, yes.
Yep.
I know what you're getting at. Yeah, that's I think we had heard a little bit about that, and he's pretty unsavory, low-life kind of individual. And I do believe they did fire him for his behavior.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Let's hold on, folks. I'm going to bring on another caller.
And I am
Thanks, Erin. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Caller, you're on the air. Do you have a question? Hello?
Hi, can you hear me?
I can.
This is Dina Wood.
Hi, Dina.
Hi,
Dina.
Hi, Dina
Wood. For our listeners, Dina Wood was Cara's high school teacher. Hi, Dina. Thank you so much for calling in.
Oh, it's just so heartbreaking for me every time I come back to this. Obviously not as much as for you, but it's just amazing to me, as someone who lived in Colorado Springs at that time and then left. I hate to say it, but it doesn't surprise me in some ways. The verdict, just because of the mindset there, unfortunately. I have some questions, though, since I've kind of been away. Why was not his mother brought to some sort of justice over this?
That's a very good question. Apparently, they made the call probably in exchange for her being a cooperative witness for the prosecution, although they had personally told me they felt that she was despicable. In fact, D.A. Michael Allen, those were his very words. But I believe they, although they didn't say as much, we were, of course, we don't really get to know the ins and outs of these things, but I think it was a little bit of that, that they wanted to ensure that she'd be cooperative.
I mean, I think back to, you know, when all of this first occurred and how so terrible the investigation was, that I think that's partly why I was shocked yet not shocked. I just want you to know, you know, I still carry Kara in my heart forever. You know, it's like, and I think that there are a lot of other people who do. And I think that if anything good is coming out of this at all, is that people are kind of going on and trying to make sure that this kind of miscarriage of justice doesn't happen again. I know
what
that's
kind
a little help.
Was Kara?
She's great.
Tell us a little bit, because I remember when we did, we had you on Inside Edition or one of the national stations where you did an interview, and you said she was so smart and talented.
Oh,
tell us a little bit about it.
Kara was extremely bright, as anyone who met her knew. She was very talented. She was extremely creative. I'm not trying to gloss over any, you know, she was a teenager. So there were, you know, there were times, but she was never, honestly, never, ever disrespectful to me. And any other teacher that I knew of at the school that she was at then, it was, I really had high hopes for her when she left and when I left too. But she was not, I don't know, she was not a bad kid in her heart, in her soul. You know, and that was really obvious. She was a beautiful, absolutely stunningly beautiful young woman physically on the outside, and she was also very beautiful inside. And so when I saw some of the stuff later that portrayed her, and as we all know, Kara had problems. You know, she, like many people do, like many, many young people, many of my former students do. Yet she was portrayed only as this certain stereotype, and I was shocked that that was allowed into the trial.
Yeah,
that really,
we had asked them about that repeatedly for the year and a half leading up to the trial, and they said, "Oh no, we'll be very careful, and we'll make, you know, we'll make note if the defense steps out of line." None of that happened. To the point where the defense was referring to her as it or the escort, never by her name. And we had to message our victim advocate to text the prosecutors to ask them to refrain from the most offensive of their tactics. And they promised us, well, we talked to the defense, and they said, we said, if this continues, we'll bring it up to the judge. And so it abated slightly, but it was deplorable. It was an absolute deplorable thing for any parent to have to sit through, as we had to endure. We also had to witness the defense team laughing and joking with the defendant. We had to endure witnesses from the sheriff's department in the vestibule, where I would go occasionally when I couldn't bear to hear some of the testimony, especially the coroner's report. And I had to witness people joking about the case, detectives, sheriff's detectives. sitting around
this,
joking.
And I wish I could say that surprised me.
I have
but
to,
it doesn't.
I had to ask this one of them to refrain and say, do you realize who's sitting here? So, I mean, the unprofessionalism, even I was surprised. Of course, I come from a much bigger metropolitan area, and I'm not on here to try to bash my former, the town that I lived in for so long, but it came across as such an unprofessional place. And like you say, Dina, the mindset, frankly, we weren't that surprised either. We were very disappointed, but
right.
we also believed there was a lot of naivete on the part of good-intentioned people prosecuting this case who should have known their audience, who should have known the kind of community and the kind of jury that they would get in Colorado Springs, and should have prosecuted it a little differently. Even having a male prosecutor might have helped in such a place.
We mentioned District Attorney Michael Allen in the past on this show, and he was quoted to Dan Abrams' Law and Crime that this violent, senseless crime deserves a more severe punishment than the law can provide. Following the sentencing hearing, he stated, "We urge the Department of Corrections to uphold the defendant's sentence." Do we really believe that?
Well, I mean, it was nice of him to say as much, but too little too late, frankly.
I think, too, I don't know if you, if everybody's aware, but the El Paso County Sheriff's Department back at that time was having scandal after scandal within the department mm-hmm. themselves. And
sure.
I think that that might have been kind of a, not the reason, but I mean, this is the kind of thing that would have just been peripheral, because within their ranks, there was scandal after scandal after scandal of sheriffs and detectives and things like that. So part of me, I guess, felt naive and in some way and thought that, you know, maybe justice would finally happen. But I don't know. I mean, I wish I knew what I could do now. Unfortunately, you know, like, what can we do now to help make sure that not just that this doesn't happen again, but also that Cara's memory is kept alive as the beautiful person we knew.
Yeah,
I think that's
a huge thing to say, but it's like it's important to me that somehow or another I make sure, and I certainly do, you know, on social media, I try to repost things that every year, you know, this was my, you know, wonderful student and this kind of thing. And I will say that there is a small group at least of people in the Springs. They tend to be women who were just appalled at the whole circus of the trial and concerned for themselves too, because, and honestly, what's to stop this? You know, what's to stop it?
I don't mean
to drag this on.
No, you're fine, Dina. When I did media interviews after the trial, what I said was, put your money where your mouth is, Judge Bain, and the prosecutors, the defense attorneys, anybody else listening, because the judge made it clear that he did not like the sentence he had to hand down because of the laws restricting him, which I find ludicrous because every law has a clause in it. But if you mm-hmm. don't like it, then why aren't you fighting to change it while you still have tenure? Why aren't you trying to change the law now?
Correct.
If you don't like what you have to hand down to a man that not only probably, remember, we only have the narrative of what he gave to the police and to his defense attorneys. So for all we know, he raped and murdered and buried Kara. But let us not forget methodically how he did it. He buried her.
Yes.
With numerous pounds of duct tape and garbage bags. If that wasn't bad enough, then he put lime on her to hide the evidence. And so for me, where Aaron was saying, you know, the property, the infrared showed hot spots and the police passed it off as animals. Well, they probably at that point also passed off the spot that they did eventually find Kara in as an animal
yes.
hot spot. So
right,
I say
right.
they need to dig up that property because I
Thank
will go
you.
To
yes.
my deathbed believing that the tip we received in 2013-14 that said there were 10 women, 10 girls' bodies on a ranch, if Kara's number one, there's still 8 to 9 other girls or women that somebody else is looking for. And we
right.
owe it to that community to tear up that property in order to see
yes.
what else is underground.
Here's the other thing, too, Michelle.
I still don't understand why that's not – I'm sorry. Excuse me. I don't understand why that's not been done. Why haven't they gone in?
Because it's a CYA. It's from start to finish. You know, we had a sheriff's detective perjure himself on the stand and lie about it, things like that. You know, I believe that they don't have the desire to uncover the truth because it'll make them look bad. And that seems
Absolutely.
To be a motivating force mm-hmm. above and beyond anything else. But mind you, the other thing that I think went unnoticed in the flurry of details was there was another DNA signature on that duct tape. He had an accomplice. So there is another person out there.
Mm-hmm. I bet it was his father.
Brown killing women. You know, so if El Paso County is okay with that, if precious little I can do here in Cook County, Illinois, about their lack of
right.
will to find violent abusers of women and murderers.
This is Dr. Kathy. I'd like to add to that because that's really important that, first of all, Aaron was saying that at the ranch there were these other anomalies that were detected. Number two, if you guys want them to go out and search, there must be pressure put on them. So social media, news media, I mean, it's amazing if there's enough people that all get together that demand from the police department, sheriff's department, whatever, that they take an action based on the fact that there's others missing, there were other anomalies. I don't care. Of course they might put a body next to an animal because then nobody will look for it because it's next to an animal that they've already buried, et cetera, et cetera. But there is something everybody can do, and that's put pressure on them. And you know, one person that gets a friend and others, and there's more and more people that say, we're not gonna sit back and be quiet. We're actually going to do something about this. And what we're going to do is put pressure on you because you're hiding something. We all know you screwed up, but there's got to be accountability there, and further evidence is even more accountability when they are trying to divert and you know, have people turn away and think of other things, et cetera, rather than staying focused on the thing of truth and finding the truth. I have a question for Julia because I know we're getting close to running out of time, but, you know, when it comes to your daughter, And you were talking about the horrors that you had to endure, you know, not only sitting in the courtroom, but when you actually stepped out to try, you know, to get a spot where you weren't having to be traumatized by what was going on in the courtroom. And then there were these other people that were, you call them unprofessional. I call them more than that. Unprofessional is definitely part of what they were, but they were also very unempathetic. They had no empathy for anything going on. They had objectified a person who was actually killed. And so, you know, I could go on and on with that type of person.
And they
and
knew
I can give
who
you
Julia
diagnosis.
Was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
so
I can give a diagnosis.
Like they were talking.
Right. But what I want to know, Julia, is this. How did you maintain yourself emotionally and psychologically and physically through this horrible, horrible process? What did you do? Because you're sitting there listening and you can't talk and you can't say a lot, and we've gone through all of that already. So what are some of the things that you did and your husband did during this time to manage all of this injustice going on?
Well, I took a lot of notes and did some breathing techniques and things and some meditating. And again, I stepped out whenever I couldn't stand it anymore. And much of the time I stepped out when this one defense attorney was so despicable. She used a little girl voice to try to ingratiate herself to the judge and jury. It was really disgusting. So there were times I just couldn't stand it. But yeah, I tried to use calming techniques, breathing exercises. I had a little fidget thing in my pocket, different things like that, counting backwards in Spanish, and anything I could to block out some of the heinousness. At the same time trying to take notes enough to know what was going on. And also there were times when my note-taking led me to notify the prosecutor about something that she was missing. For instance, they played this really long recorded interview with the defendant where the sheriff's the detectives were jollying him along and trying to be, you know, good cop, bad cop, and being really friendly with him as a technique. And the jury was nodding their heads like, yeah, if the detectives think he's a good guy, I guess he is a good guy. And so I alerted the victim's advocate so that she would alert the prosecutor to cross-examine the detective and make sure the jury knew that this was an interview technique. Because believe it or not, I don't think they would have picked up on it.
Yeah, they did it.
So,
okay.
Anyway, I mean, that
yeah,
it
they,
was hard to maintain our sanity.
They listened to Julia. They did listen to Julia and Paul every time. Julia wasn't in the courtroom in the beginning when they started referencing Kara as it. And so we would alert Julia, and then Paul would tell the DA. They started changing their terminology and addressing Kara as the victim or Kara. But when Julia said something to the advocate and the advocate gave it over to the DA, then she did question him on the stand, the police officer, and he did explain that was an interview tactic.
Okay.
So why should the victim's mother have to be calling her on that?
Well,
you know, I
precisely.
Guess maybe we watch too much SVU or something or Law and Order, but the fact is victims shouldn't have to work so hard in getting justice. We should expect the educated, trained, certified people that are DAs and defense attorneys, et cetera, to know how to handle a case as sensitive as Kara's is, or any other case for that matter. It shouldn't be up to the victim's family to say, stop calling my daughter an it. That should come down to like the empathetic, like you were talking, Dr. Mathis. So It is mind-boggling to watch what happens in the courtrooms across this country these days.
Well, thank you, Julia. Yeah, thank you for sharing that, because, you know, there may be other moms and dads listening and, you know, needing to know how you managed to make it through, and to share what you did, you know, might be very helpful to them as well. And I have one other question that I want to ask you, and that is, how, now that we are where we are at this point in time, how do you want Tara remembered, and how do you want to make a difference for other people?
Well, I want her remembered as the beautiful teenage girl who did not deserve the monstrous injustice that occurred to her. I want her to be remembered as a beautiful spirit who hopefully is watching us now and somehow helping in the process of further justice. And I like to think that she is watching out for other young women out there and for other souls who may need a little bit of extra care. So that is
excellent.
That's what I like to think of in these days, to try to help alleviate some of my sorrow.
So
and
I
then,
have go ahead, Dr. Mathis.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, and I know that a lot of the parents that I have talked to who have had children murdered, they want to make sure that that child's life makes a difference for our society, our community, and for other people. And so is there anything that you are looking at or wanting to do that is going to be something that you hope her legacy and her memory is going to make a difference for others?
Well, I would like to continue speaking out against this kind of injustice and many other injustices in her name, because I believe she would want that. And had she been able to live her life, she would be fighting for vulnerable populations who really need someone watching out for them and advocating. So I would like to do a lot more of that in the future.
Thank you.
And I think that won't be a problem. You know, we have a lot on the horizon as far as continuing to say her name, Cara Nancy Nichols. I have just a couple things. And, again, we want to thank Dina Wood, Cara's high school teacher that phoned in, and as well as one of Cara's best friends, Erin. And I thank Erin and her friend Autumn. Autumn's working right now, who made statements in court and gave victim impact statements from friends. And there's a video and one of the speeches and such on CaraNichols.org that will continue. So if you go to CaraNichols.org, you'll see a lot of the news and any updates, because we still have another hearing on residual hearing at some point on the horizon as well. But I want to talk a little bit about the process, Julia. You know, there is, you know, we can all write a handbook about what to do when your child goes missing. We could all make white sheets and everything else about the, you know, the bullet points that one should follow. But until you walk in your shoes, you really truly never understand what a family of a missing child goes through. But then when your child is now found deceased, that takes on a different persona. And then when the child's murderer is found, then that takes on another thing. And I, maybe this is a question for Dr. Mathis. No matter what Julia's been doing for 11 years to be able to take care of herself, her husband, her other children, what have you, that's a lot of trauma in 11 years to keep watching the door hit you in the face. What do families going through the same thing, or families that still have no answers, what would you advise them to all do, Dr. Mathis?
That's such a good question, because we know that families either become stronger and closer because of a trauma, or they can break up and fall apart because of it. So everybody, you know, around a trauma responds differently. And what a family has to remember is that patience with each other and the way each other responds is very, very important. Also, each person needs their own therapist or psychologist to talk to, or trauma expert to talk to help them through their own personal experiences. And then the family as a unit needs to also meet as a family unit to go through this process. So you've got, you know, you've got individual, you know, therapy and counseling, and then you have the family unit itself. If you want to maintain some kind of bondedness to each other through the process, and again, love and patience, because you respond one way and somebody else may be responding some other way, and you don't get it, you don't understand it, but that's not your place to understand them. It's to be patient and let them work through their process while you're working through yours. So my answer is, you know, individual processing of the trauma with somebody that you trust and that is a trauma expert. And the other thing is the family as a whole also go together as an entire family unit and get therapy. And usually, you know, the therapist, one of the therapists, if not several of them, will also recommend that the family go and do a family therapy session through this process as well, or sessions, I should say.
That's
right. That's very helpful, for sure.
Let's talk about NW Cave just for a tad bit before we close out the show. As I mentioned in the intro, we were referred to you by Bruce. May he rest in peace. He died of cancer during the last 11 years. He was a wonderful reporter from the Orlando Sentinel, and he saw a need of a young lady that was being re-victimized and with a lot of biases from law enforcement in the way that they were handling and getting the word out about Cara when she was missing. We got involved November 1st. And when I say that no family should have to work as hard as families of missing and murdered children, that is an understatement, because I have seen so many families in the last 15 years lose loved ones, lose jobs, lose their homes, etc. Not every family can go the distance as you and your family has, trying to get the word out about Kara. For our listeners, there were so many opportunities with our media partners across the country that we were able to follow so-called tips, which now I begin to think that Hollendorfer probably made them up in order to get us off the track. We went to California, to Venice. Then there was a time where all of a sudden there was sightings and tips coming into the sheriff's office that they made it seem as if they had to investigate in Vegas. So I went to Vegas, you know, and then there was somebody that took us off of the .com site and then pulled that out in Oregon. So it was an ongoing thing. When we're trying to keep her face and case visible, we always knew we were hitting a nerve with somebody when something else happened, whether it was with the sheriff's office, whatever the case may be. Can you tell our listeners a little bit, because so many people wonder what we do and why we do it. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about your experience working with us?
Sure. Well, it was a lifesaver, Michelle. I don't really think this case would have ever been solved without NWK's involvement. At all. They certainly were not willing to even look for my daughter because she was 19. It's a bit of a catch-22. When your child is younger than 18, they say, oh, your child's a runaway. They'll come home. And when they're over 18, oh, they're an adult. They've left on their own volition. So they were not going to investigate until you got involved and your organization, Michelle, and put media pressure on them. And kept that pressure going year in, year out. So really, the scary thing, Michelle, is how many people who go missing and families don't have any recourses, even if they beg and plead law enforcement, how many people get away with murder in this country?
Wow.
I'm left with that. Because this guy certainly had a recipe for getting away with murder. He almost did. And so without N.W. Cave, I have no doubt that he'd still be walking around, fancy free, doing what he does. And we would have no answers about our daughter, and we would just have to live with that chasm in our lives. So extremely grateful for everything you've done, Michelle.
Thank you. And how does it make you feel to know that we can all still be in this world when he gets out?
Oh, I don't even want to think about that. Yeah.
What's it going to take to make sure that the DA's request of the correctional system actually happens, that they keep him behind bars?
I don't know. We'll all be 10 years older, and that's not easy to do when you're elderly. But till my dying day, if I have to fly to Canyon City or wherever the prison system is where he is, I will show up at any in every parole hearing and read my victim impact statement again and again and again.
It was very strong, too, by the way.
Oh. Took me the rest of the summer to write it.
Say that again.
Pardon?
What did you say?
It took me the rest of the summer processing that trial to write it, but
I was really surprised that Judge Bain allowed Aaron and Autumn and myself, not to mention the two police officers, which I've never seen happen before, I think that it should be protocol for any agency, whether it's the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, Shared Hope, us, whomever is the agency working with the family, when things transpire like this, we should all have a say, because what he did, and I said it in my statement, I know that he, his mother, his father, maybe the ex-wife, all sat around, holidays. The kids are playing in the backyard, right where your daughter was, everything. And they knew she was missing. You know, they knew you were on the television. They knew the flyers Dina put up around town, and Autumn and Aaron. And that in itself should be a crime. All the added support services from somewhat of the law enforcement agencies and state agencies and you name it, and all the businesses that allowed the flyer to be put up. Everybody did their part, and he sat back watching us work for almost 10 years. That in itself should be criminal. So that's my piece on that, because I think 11 years is a long time to keep searching and fighting. And what so many people don't understand also is families, the victim compensation, if you're lucky to get it, is minimal. Cara's remains had to be shipped to Chicago. Only portions do they cover anything. At the end of the day, the families and the public are what help pay for searching for someone missing, helping bury somebody that's been murdered. But nobody's paying for the counseling sessions. If you're lucky to get victims' compensation, we're just finding out here in our backyard, if you make too much, you don't qualify. Well, I didn't think it was there based on that. I thought it was there based on if you're a victim. So there's so many things that need to be reevaluated and changed, and it takes a village. It takes a village. Any last thoughts, Julia, before we go?
Well, this is the kind of ordeal that I wouldn't wish on anyone, and I just do believe that the whole system needs an overhaul from top to bottom, because I never would have believed that this was how the process would be. And I think that people should know that this is not just something that happens to those kind of people or somebody else, or you brought it on yourself, because people like to other victims and victims' families. The scary thing is it can happen to anyone. And that's the truth.
Dr. Mathis?
I just want to say, Julia, you have our empathy. You have our condolences. You have our support. You have our arms going through the air around you and your family, because this does not end. It continues on. And everybody listening out there can make a difference for a family like Cara Nichols' family, because there's not just one victim here. There's multiple victims here. And if you want to make a difference, then put the pressure on law enforcement. Put the pressure on the judicial system and on the judges through your social media, et cetera, et cetera. Be there for when these families need support, not only emotionally, but also financially, because as Michelle just mentioned, there are so many things in the process of a court case where the resources are lacking. So if anybody is listening and says, I can make a difference, I can do this, I can start a foundation, or I can start a fund that will go to help these family members with the financial needs that come up because of the different things that they are facing, then step up to the plate and do it. Don't sit back and say, oh, this was horrible. Yeah, it was horrible. You have no idea, if it hasn't happened to you, how horrible it can be. But instead of saying that, step up and actually do something. And I'm going to say this again. When you see something, say something. When you hear something, say something. Because anything and everything can make a difference. Even if you don't think it's important, tell somebody anyway.
Definitely.
And yeah, absolutely.
Nope, go ahead, Julia.
No, thank you very much for saying all that. That's so true. And maybe that's part of Cara's legacy going forward, that my family and I can make a difference too.
Well, thank you again for being with us. You know, you have amazing courage, resilience, and tenacity. And I honor all that and you and your family as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Julia. And please extend our hearts over to Paul, Cara's father, and her brother and sister and aunt. And we will be in touch. And I want to remind our listeners tonight that it is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. If you know someone or you're in a situation, please call 1-800-799-SAFE, or you can visit thehotline.org. Our next show will be October 30th. We will be speaking about domestic violence. And we will also be speaking in reference to our Advocacy Center for Justice, where we will keep saying Cara's name, and we will be talking to so many of our other clients that they, too, are going through this. And what we're finding, this isn't just happening in Colorado Springs, unfortunately. This is happening everywhere. And we must, and I've been saying this until I have no voice, the laws need to change. The laws need to benefit the victims and survivors of crime, not the other way around, not the other way around. And unfortunately, this week alone, we were to be in court on two different cases, and once again, those cases are seeing continuances for the benefit of the criminal, the rapist, the murderer. This needs to stop. It just needs to stop. The victims deserve better, and that's what the laws were put there for. And to quote our Attorney General, Bob Ferguson, from an event last night, he said, "We are the people's office." Well, if that's the case, then prosecutors and district attorneys need to do better throughout this country to remember who they're fighting for, who they're fighting for. So with that, I want to say thank you, Julia, for being our guest this evening, and I'm happy you were able to say what you wanted to say for many, many years that you were prevented from saying. We have our work still cut out for us. We're still working on things with the Nichols family for the next step for Cara. And then we also want to thank Anthony Mossberg, as always, for the song he's provided for our show, Spotlight for Justice. And again, you too can make a difference. If you see something, say something.
Go ahead, Dr. Miller. Any last thoughts, ladies?
No, just thank you so much, and I appreciate all that you do.
Thank you, Julia. Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Mathis. Until next time, thank you for joining us on Spotlight for Justice, and we are going to leave you with Anthony's song.
I've tried a thousand times to break down my door, and I've lied a thousand lies to try to get beyond.